What's good, what's good, what's good, people? It's your man, Ken Cook. Listen to me podcast. I want to talk briefly about an episode I got coming up with producer Mark Berg, Chicago super producer. Recorded this about a week ago, and I haven't dropped it yet because we was having some audio issues. So when I get ready and drop, I just want to prelude you guys to know that you know, starting off is going to get a little low. You know, his volume was kind of low. But around the two-minute mark, everything picks back up. So if you guys bear with me, I apologize for that. It's a very great interview with Mark Berg. And I definitely want to get it out to the people. So please excuse any editing or audio volume in the beginning of the video, of the podcast. But it definitely picks up and it's definitely worth the listen. Thank you guys for rocking with me, man. I really appreciate the love. And more interviews, more conversations with Ken Cook on Listen to Me podcast will be coming soon. Got a lot of good people lined up to talk to, a lot of topics that we want to cover. But for right now, this is Mark Berg, super producer, Grammy-nominated songwriter. This guy has an awesome story. Thank you for listening. Good afternoon, world. Good afternoon, coronavirus people, lockdown people, all my people that's on shutdown, lockdown, stuck in the crib right now. You listen to Me podcast with Ken Quick Cook. I got a very special guest today from the crib, from Chicago, artist, Grammy-nominated songwriter. He got a list of credits that you guys should know of. If you don't, man, after this podcast, y'all need to reach out and get some of this guy work. If you probably heard him dance to and juke to some of his beats and didn't even know it was him. I'm talking about super producer. And I'm going to call him a super producer because I think he is super at it. Reclusive. Lay low. He not out there like you. He's not in the limelight. Man. After doing my research on him and trying to find more interviews with him, I noticed that no one from Chicago has interviewed this guy before. So I'm going to try my best and give it my best. I hope you guys enjoy it. I'm talking about Mark Berg. Mark, you there? Yo. Yeah, you sound real low. I don't know what happened. Same thing. Hold on. Mark, you on? What's going on, man? How you doing? Maintaining, man. Trying to stay out of this virus. Yeah. Now, I was telling the people before you got on, man, that some of them probably know some of the work that you've done, and some probably don't. So, tell me what you think one of your biggest beats is that people would probably know about.
I'll probably chalk that up to either, I don't know, it's kind of hard to gauge because, like, the people that I've produced for have such different fan bases. Partly, people might say the Rhapsody record. Some people might say Saha, or some people might even say Jack Harlow. So it's kind of hard to gauge.
Okay.
Me personally, I'll say my favorite joint is probably the Rhapsody Nina record, just because the exposure that it got, like her performing it on an award show and everything else. So I'll say that one.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorites. Maybe because it's one of the newest and it did get a lot of exposure. And those of you don't know, man, y'all check out Rhapsody. The first song on her album is called Nina, and that was produced by Mark Berg. And it's a very deep, deep song. I don't know where you got that from, bro. But that was, tell me that process, man. How did that work out? Did she call you? Did you already have the beat, or did you design it specifically for what she was trying to do?
Crazy thing is, I made the beat one day after, like, watching this movie. I made the record. And after I made it, in my mind, I just felt like not too many people could get it. Like, one of the only people that I thought could get it, I knew they wouldn't take the record. So, with that being said, I just sat on it. And I was on tour with Chris and Saha. We were doing a tour, and we stopped. We had a show in North Carolina, and one of my homeboys, my man Scuba Steve, aka Code Red. Code Red knows the whole Jamla squad, so he hit nice. And I was doing my laundry, and he called me and was like, because he had a free day in North Carolina. He called, was like, yo, get back to the tour bus. I'm taking you over here to meet Knife. So I'm like, all right, bet. So I get back to the bus. I meet Knife one day, I meet Crisis. I mean, pretty much the whole Jamla squad. And Rhapsody came in. So we was all just hanging around talking. You know, I wasn't even playing records really. And then I don't know how it got there. Then somebody was like, yo, go play rap records. And then we went in the back room. And I played it like 10, 12 beats. He took like 10 of them. But the Nina record was in there. And I remember, I knew that it was going to be something because I remember Knife Wonder coming back in the room like 3 or 4 times and was like, yo, play that shit again. And at that moment, I was like, okay, if Knife is rocking with it like that, then this must be a special joint.
Right.
She took the record again and she was like, I think she had recorded like 1 or 2 songs prior to Nina. But she was like, once she recorded that, that really shaped the album and where it was
going to
go.
Wow. Now we kind of starting on the back end of your career and not from the beginning, which is cool. That's cool because Nina is a big song, bro, and it's a hot record. I listen to the joint probably 5 times a day. That's how cold it. I wonder if the movie you saw was the Nina Simone documentary.
No, it was actually Birth of a Nation.
Oh, Birth of a Nation. Okay.
And they played Strange Fruit at the end of Birth of a Nation. And, you know, people have heard Strange Fruit millions of times.
And it depicted like that and showing, like,
visuals of what Nina was singing about emotions that made me go direct. Because I was like, I remember it being sampled on the Kanye joint, on the
lead joint. But I was just like, man, I felt like there was an emotion in it that wasn't brought out. So that's what made me go touch it.
Cool. Now, again, like I said, doing my research, and I listened to a lot of songs that you have done over the course of like a week or two. And one thing I noticed is that you can't really identify. Like, do Mark Burr have a sound? Because it seems like you can do pretty much any and everything. But you know how some producers, you know who that is when the beat first drop. Like, some producers, and then some have a tag, like they're. That they want to be known as the producer of the song. But it seemed like with you, you just do the music and give it to the artist and say, go with it. You know, and then...
Not to cut you off, but right. I used to think that was a downfall for a long time because we always say that, man, the best producer, man, you just know it when you hear it.
Right.
And it's like, okay, but... If you, like you say, you studied a lot of my music in like the past week or two, one thing that you'll find synonymous, two things really, is my music is emotional.
Yes.
There's always some type of emotion in it, whatever it is, and my drums always jump out.
Right.
Those are my two things, because I remember one of my homies. He was like, man, what is the Chicago sound? He was like, if y'all could describe it, what would it be? And I was just like, man, it's emotional. From every artist that we have from the crib, man, from the Common to the Ye to the Lupe to the Twista to the, you know what I'm saying? Man, we can go back to Psychodrama, the Snipers, like Bump, everybody. It's some type of emotion that gets invoked in that music. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember when I first heard the Snipers joint, I was like, ooh, the way that that joint just made me feel. Or when I first heard Do or Die's No Love, and then hearing Ye, and then hearing Common, even hearing Lupe. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. It's emotional. Even R. Kelly, it's emotional. Carl Thomas, emotional. Perfect example.
Right.
That's the sound of the crib. So that's always been my thing, like something like emotional. And I think, like, once I get into the driver's seat where I want to be, I'm actually in that seat with an artist. So when people start to hear full projects, I think people, once they hear a full-on project, well, I'm like, you know what I'm saying, the chains is off and I can just go. I think that's what people understand the sound.
Yeah.
It's emotional and theatrical.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a detriment, man. And I actually think that's pretty dope that you're not, you don't have that, you know, you're not trying to put yourself as a producer in front of the artist. You know what I'm saying? Like, you hear all these tags of all these producers, you know, London Made It or whatever the hell, you know, all the different tags, and you don't have any of that, you know, on none of your beats that I've heard. No, this is a Mark Byrd beat. Nothing like that. I think that's kind of cliche. It's getting kind of redundant with producers nowadays, you know? I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, man, I think the tags is kind of cool because a lot of times, man, you got to think when all of these mixtapes was coming out, like when like the Gucci's and all of these folks was doing all of these mixtapes, the credits were never listed anywhere.
Yeah.
So how would we know who did what?
You got a point.
So I think the tags help because even nowadays, like, man, I'll be listening to records. And I use Tidal because Tidal is, like, one of the best for, like, uploading the credits. But it'd be sometimes I go to an album, and I'm like, man, who did the record? And then I'm looking in the credits, and there's no, they don't list the credits. So it's like, damn, man, how am I going to know who did this stuff? But if I hear, like, if I'm listening to a record and I hear OG Parker at the beginning, I was like, okay, OG Parker.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So yeah. I think the tags is kind of like, they became a necessity just because, like, man, people started to forget about the producers.
Right. Right. You got a good point, bro. You got a good point. Yeah. I didn't think about that. Well, I'm from the age era where we actually had to get CDs and open up the credit. That used to be the first thing you do is open up a lineup to see who did what. I remember I'm a huge Prince fan, man. And when I got that first Prince album, I think it had to be Purple Rain. And I opened it up and said, damn, he did everything. Everything. But well, you wouldn't have known that if you, like nowadays, the way people get music, like you said, you wouldn't have known that Prince written, arranged, produced, played drums, pianos, all of that shit on majority of those songs if you didn't open up the liner and read the credits. So, yeah, you do have, right. you got a point, man. You got a point. And I think, you know, producers don't get, they just do. Because a lot of times, the production is what makes the song. And if, you know, if you don't know who did it, then that producer don't get that credit.
Exactly, man. There's been so many records. And the reason I be wanting to look at the notes is because, man, like, because now that I've crossed over to the other side, like, as my brother Focus would put it, I went from standing in front of the table to being behind the table. Now that I'm behind the table, a lot of these records are my peers. So, you know what I'm saying? I can't watch everybody's Instagram, but if I'm listening to an album, and I hear a tag, or I go to look at the liner or the credits, and there's no names listed because a lot of these cats upload songs with no names, like no credits.
Right.
So, like, that tag helps me, and I'll be like, okay, cool. Now I know who to call and tell them that they killed this record.
Right.
Because that's what I feel like. Right. Like, yo, you smashed this joint, bro.
Right.
Like, I'm one of those guys. I'm still a fan at the end of the day.
No doubt, no doubt. All right, let's take it back. Let's take it back, Breezy. Let's take it back to Chicago.
Okay.
West Side, right?
Yeah, West Side.
West Side. Young kid coming up. And because I know a little of your background, but we're gonna let the people know. And I didn't know this that you got on your first song, your first verse when you was 8 as a rapper.
Yeah, I was 8, man. My uncle, Fresh, had a group called HMH, and he was a legend. He was my first superhero. You know what I'm saying? He was like one of the only people I knew that actually made beats and wrote rhymes and everything. Like, he was a b-boy at the core, so like he would teach me everything, and I would just learn from him. And he would tell me how to put rhymes together. And of course, it was like, you know, super early. Like, I was 8, it was 89, so it was still like little comedic punchlines or whatever. So he taught me how to do that, and then once I did it, you know what I'm saying, he took me to the studio, you know what I'm saying, if you're from the crib, then you'll remember the factory over on that.
Yes, yes,
you know
yes.
That's, That's where they used to record at.
Yep.
So he took me to the factory, and I laid my first verse. That was the first time I ever got to hear myself on tape, you know what I'm saying? And I actually performed that verse a couple times, too. Like, when he had shows, he'll bring me out. And, you know, of course, that wowed the crowd. You know, these dudes is rapping, then they bring out the little kid.
Right.
And I pop out in, like, a troop jumpsuit or whatever and do my thing and go back on, you know what I'm saying? Somebody had to take me home after that because, you know, the party got a little wild.
Yeah. Rest in peace, your Uncle Fresh, man. I knew Fresh. I went to school with him. We wasn't close. Like, but you know how you know some cats, how they move? Like, the way he was moving, everybody knew him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
he was a year or two older than me, but everybody knew who Fresh was, you know? And he brought that to the school. And everybody knew that he was an artist. Everybody knew that, you know, that he was a performer. And, yeah, I saw Fresh at the factory a couple of times. That was my man. Yeah, he was a good dude, man. So
yeah, man, that's where I got it from. The energy, the love, you know what I'm saying? All that for the music came from him.
Man, that's what's up. So now you're an artist or you're a rapper. You know, you got your first verse at 8 years old, and then now you're gonna pursue the rap career.
Then I just started writing raps all the time. Like, all right, cool. You know what I'm saying? I used to write these little corny poems. Then I was like, man, I'm about to just start writing raps. Then I started writing raps. Me and the homies in school, writing verses to any instrumental that we could find. And then, like, I used to be, like, in K-Town, you know what I'm saying, on, like, you know, Fullerton and Kilboy with my cousin.
Mm.
And I was, like, notorious in that neighborhood for knowing how to rap. So whenever anybody, cousins or whoever came to the crib, you know what I'm saying, came over there, like, yeah, I rap, they would have to come and get me. Like, you had to come and see me. Because I just made myself that guy, like, in the neighborhood. Like, I'm a
right.
And that's when I started, like, battling and just learning more about rap structure.
Right.
So then I was, like, full-on artist. And it just carried over for so many years. And then even when I moved, I just stayed rapping because that became my
piece. Right. You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So now you rapping. How did you get into the production side of it?
I was always into it, being around my uncle. Okay. Like, he would always leave the crib, and he would always leave, like, drum machines and keyboards in the house. So I always sneak in his room and learn how to use these joints. Like, this, I never forget the joint. It was a Casio SK-1. Never forget that keyboard as long as I live. It was, like, the first keyboard I learned how to make beats on. It had, like, a little voice sampler. So I used to, like, say my name, say something into the sample and chop it up, put a little drum break behind it. So, like, then is when I learned how to, like, produce. But, you know what I'm saying, when I really started to get really, really into the music, around that time I had left Chicago, you know what I'm saying, got into a little trouble, you know what I'm saying, so felt it would be best for me to leave, so I moved down to Augusta, Georgia.
Okay.
And that's where I really started to dive deep into the music, you know what I'm saying? All of the homies was rapping. Everybody in high school was rapping at that point.
Right.
It was like, oh, okay, it's more than just me. All right, bet. So I just started sharpening my skills, just being around a lot of other rappers, like dudes from all over. I don't know why Augusta was such a melting pot. Well, I guess because the military, but it was like kids from Jersey, kids from New York, Michigan, Chicago, everywhere, New Orleans. So that's where I started to, like, immerse in the different cultures and just learning from other people how to do certain things. And then, like, I met this guy named Buck, and Buck was, like, the first producer that had a unique sound. Like, Buck was one of those, when I heard it, he was like, okay, I know that's a Buck beat. And I started to sit with him, and he started to teach me the MPC and teach me the Triton and show me other stuff all the while I was rapping. So then it was just like, okay, when I figured out that nobody could really do the beats that I wanted to rap over, all right, now it's time for me to do these beats.
And this was all in Augusta?
Yeah, this was all in Augusta.
So you went to Georgia and then came back and then went back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's take you back to Chicago where you now you producing and rapping more so.
Okay, so now we all the way back in Chicago.
Yeah.
Because there was another stop before Chicago.
Okay.
Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
Baltimore was a stop.
Okay.
So I went to Baltimore. It was like an indie label, and I used to sell them production.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So I ended up moving there because, you know, they was like, yeah, we'll take care of you. You come up, you produce for the label or whatever. So I'm like, all right, bet. I ain't had nothing else to do. I was like, all right, cool. Let me do this for show, for show. So I went up there, and that's when I really dove deep into creating songs and producing artists, like multiple artists, like learning everybody's personality, creating records strictly for that person, helping this person write hooks, telling this person how to structure and all of that. That's where I really dove into full-on production. And then, like, one of the homies called and was asking about me, asking the big homie about me, was like, yo, how you doing? And they was like, yo, the kid is a machine. He does not do anything but make music. And then the other homie was like, yo, did he rap yet? And they were like, what? He rapped? Because I had never rapped.
Okay.
To them.
Right.
I'm like, y'all brought me for production. Y'all didn't ask if I could rap.
Right.
And then when they asked if I could rap, I had already had like 10, 12 songs in a can. So like when everybody would leave the studio, I would spend nights there and I would just record my own stuff. So I started playing the records. And he was like, man, what the hell? You rap just as good as you produce. And then I started doing both. I was like double duty since.
How old are you at this time in Boston?
This time I was 22.
22, okay. All right.
Yeah, 22 with like 7 artists under my belt. I was producing for 7 artists.
Okay. And at that time, what was the money like on producing for an indie label? Like, what was did you have to maintain a 9-to-5 and do this, or was this it?
I did a little 9-to-5. Well, it wasn't even a 9-to-5. It was like a 10 to 4 in the morning type joint. I was doing like a little security joint at like strip clubs here and there.
Okay.
And then after a while, I just started to learn how to hustle the music. You know what I'm saying? Once people started to figure out that I was the one doing all the records, like as we would perform, people were like, man, who the hell do y'all be? And then when they find out it was me, that's when people would start to come and shop with me. So I was able to quit the 9-to-5 because I was making just as much money selling beats as I was if I would have been working.
Right. Okay. So how long was you there in Baltimore doing that?
3 years and some change. Like 3 and some change. And I came back to the crib in like December 2004.
Okay. Now you back at the crib now.
Yeah.
And now you still pursuing the rap career and producing. At what point did you get with your guys because you had a rap group. You had a group that you was a part of.
Man, when I came back to the crib, I actually formed music off, bro. I was, like, super depressed at that time.
Okay.
Man, life had kicked my ass, man. Like, I had bounced around doing so much stuff, and then it was just like, I'm back home, and now I gotta deal with every one of my demons. So I was, like, crazy depressed. I went through some stuff in Baltimore that I, you know what I'm saying, just never really shook back from. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, now I did, of course, but right. At that time I hadn't shook back from it. So I just went into like depression mode, bro. I wasn't even making music. I didn't care no more.
Okay.
I didn't know what I was doing. I was on some Marvin Gaye shit, like in the crib, walking around in pajamas, just not doing anything with myself. And then I ran into, I was at my grandma's crib and my cousin was over there. And what's crazy is my cousin used to run with my Uncle Fresh. My cousin's name was Don.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? D-Mac. And he used to run with my uncle. So, and we all had a love for music because he used to help them produce and write, too.
Right.
So, when I seen him at my grandma's house, he's like, man, what you been doing? I heard, you know, whoopie, whoopie, whoop. So, I was like, yeah, you know what I'm saying? And I went to his crib one day, and I played him some music. And he was just like, man, what the fuck are you doing? And I was just like, man, I'm not in it anymore. And he was like, bro, you gotta get back. Like, you have to shake back. So, man, my cousin was really super, super instrumental in me coming back to music after that. Like, he made me come and live with him.
Okay.
And was just like, look, don't worry about no bills. Just jump back into this because I believe in it. He was like, even if I have to pay for all of the studio time, I will. Jump back. So, we started to create again, me and him, and he would sit there, and I would teach him what I learned, and he would show me stuff that him and my uncle used to do, and then we started fusing it. And then in looking for a studio, I ran into this guy named Matt. Shout out to my brother, Matt Universe. I ran into him at work. I was working security at HSBC. Okay. And he was like, yo, we got a studio. And I was like, okay, I'm going to come through. And it was so crazy because I just never went. I just kept saying I was going to go, and I never went. Right. And then it was like one day I went, and it was like, yo, we're going to play you some music so you can hear what the sound like. Now, at this time, me and my cousin had been to all types of studios, paying $7,500, $150 an hour type joint.
Right, right.
Nobody could make the music. It didn't feel good. It was mixing all technical, but it didn't feel like nothing. So right. I went over here and I heard these dudes' music, and it was just like the feeling of it, how they mixed it. It just made so much sense. So we was like, all right, we gonna record here. So we paid for like a few hours of studio time. I recorded like, because at this time, you gotta think, I was so into machine mode from being in Baltimore. I knew exactly how to do everything.
Right.
So it was not uncommon for me to be able to record 3 to 4 songs in 2 hours.
Okay.
Because right. Like full songs, like ad libs, everything, because I knew exactly how I wanted to do everything.
Right.
So after I recorded, me and my cousin left, and we was like, all right, we're going to make this the studio home. Lo and behold, the homies was having the same conversation about us, like, yo, we need to bring them in and just, you know, be all one big crew. And that's where, like, it started with the group. It was like, I was still solo. My man Penn was solo.
Mm-hmm.
And my man Mac was in a group with his brother. And then Mac's brother was like, yo, I just want to focus on mixing, you know what I'm saying, engineering. And we was like, all right, bet. So me and Mac started to do songs together. And then, like, I think we did, like, a couple records with Penn, because Penn at the time had the biggest buzz. So he would be doing shows. And he was like, yo, I want to bring y'all out of the show to do a joint. So we should do a song or two together. That way, like, I can do that song in my set, and y'all can go on and do a song and then finish, and then I can finish my set off. So shout out to Penn for being super unselfish.
Right.
And once we started to record songs together, we found, like, this chemistry. And it was just like, oh, this is fire.
Right.
This is fire. And then we just kept going, like, as a crew.
That's what's up. Now, what we at on years now? Like, 07?
This is like 07, 08.
Yeah.
Going into that 5, yeah, like 06, 07, 08. Like, we just gave it up. That's when we start. Like, I released my, shout out to my man, Gene. Gene was managing me, this guy named Gene Thomas. He was managing me, telling my cousin, we're taking care of, you know what I'm saying, making sure I was straight. Around the time when my cousin told me to rap, and that's when we did my first mixtape. That was like 07, something like that, with Sean Mack.
Yeah, I seen that. It's on Dead Piff right now. I seen
it's
that.
On Dead Piff? Wow.
Yeah, it's on Dead Piff. Yeah.
Yo, that is crazy.
Go to Dead Piff and type your name in. And it's like hosted by DJ Sean Mack. I'm like, well, he got a Sean Mack mixtape.
That is crazy. Yeah, I got a Sean Mack tape right yeah. Now. We did that because I was looking for like somebody to do the tape, and I wanted it to be like, I was gearing up. Like, we was really on pace. We was going to do the Sean Mack joint. Then the next plan of attack was, man, we was going to use all of our cassettes. And I was going to try to get a Gangsta Grills tape.
Ooh.
But I ended up doing me and the homies ended up forming a group. So I stopped rapping solo.
Okay. And the name of the group was what?
Project Fresh.
Project Fresh.
Yeah. So that was when, like, things started to really take off. And we started to, like, because the dynamic between us three, they kind of, you know what I'm saying, helped me commercialize myself to make a different dynamic of record.
Right.
So we started to make songs that could get radio play. And then I remember we would get Spin, shout out, man, Rare. Oh, my God, rest in peace. My man, Timbuk2.
Timbuk, yeah. Rest in peace, Timbuk2.
I met Tim in high school, bro. Okay. Like, I was going to some special high school, the Latin School of Chicago, and I met Tim in class, and me and him saying, like, super cool, just because I remember he had this polo jacket and his shirt, and I had a polo joint with a bear, with the bear on it, and he had one. We was looking at each other like, well, you did that joint. And me and him became super cool since then. Like, we learned about the affinity that we both have for hip-hop, And I just wanted to shout that out because fast forward, he would be the first DJ to ever play my music on radio.
That's what's up. Timbuktu is a legend, man.
Man, super legend, man. That was my dog, man. Wow. That hurt my soul.
No doubt. So, no doubt. We lost one day.
Yeah.
No doubt.
So he would start spending on the records, and then that's when we started to, you know, learning how to do so much other stuff on the business end and booking shows, and we would go travel. We would go to, like, Cleveland and perform at colleges and go to different areas and just build a network for ourselves. And that became, you know, Project Fresh.
Now, when did the group Project Fresh break up? Like, when did it disband? Because I know you guys did go y'all separate ways. Everything was still cool, it seemed like, but it's, you know, everyone had their own, started doing their own thing.
Man, it really happened after, it kind of happened after the first place.
Okay.
My man Jay started working with the homie Toxic, who did a lot of Twisted Junk. And we would start to filter our work through Jay to Toxic. And then Tox wanted to sign Project Fresh at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just a difference between him and our management at the time, and it just didn't pan out. But also with that, he wanted records for Twista's album. So we had records that we were doing for our project, and then we just took the verses off and sent them with the hooks. And they liked what we had and asked for more. Then we would just start filtering more music through them. And we ended up with records on the Category F5 album. And at that point is when we said that we should probably take music production and writing more serious. Now, also with that, we hadn't disbanded completely.
Okay.
We were like, once that happened, that's when we was like, okay, we got to get out of Chicago. So Project Fresh wasn't a dead thing. It was just like kind of on hold until we figured out what we was doing as producers.
Okay.
So around that time is when we left and came to Atlanta. And even during that time, I think Penn stayed back in Chicago for a minute. And while we were gathering up more placements and making more of a name for ourselves, Penn eventually came down to Atlanta and moved down here. And then we started to reignite the whole Project Fresh thing.
Okay.
This might have been like 2010, 2011, 2012. Yeah, because I remember we went to South by Southwest and we performed at a few shows out there under Project Fresh. Yeah,
they had to be between 11 and 12 because around that time, Chicago music started to change to the drill scene with the whole Chief Keef, you know, came out, and then, you know, King Louie and all those guys. So I remember when you guys, you know, kind of picked up and moved down there. But at that time, now, back to the Category F5, so that would be Mark Bird's first major placement?
Yeah, that's the first one.
What song? Which song's on there?
We had a song called Read My Mind. We had a song called Clappin', and then we had another joint that was supposed to be on the bonus called Pick That Paper Up, but they never did the reissue, so that song did not come out. Okay. But I came across it on YouTube one day.
Okay.
So it was out there. It was definitely out there.
Now, what's that feeling like, Marcus? I want to get into the mind of the emotion of, you know, getting your first placement. Now, you've been doing things kind of, you know, on your own already, and you know, had some little success, I would say. But I think making, like, a major placement with a signed artist, that got to be huge, right? So, emotionally, when you know that you had that, like, how did that feel?
Man, that was like the game changer. It was like, okay, now we really got to get serious about this. This is crazy to be able to go into Best Buy and buy an album, and we're part of it versus just working with the homies around the way.
Right.
Okay, this is different. And then, too, in the business sense, you look at it and goes, all right, this is my calling card. Now I have a business card to give people because, you know, people want to know what you've done. And now that we have something that is a major accomplishment, we can talk about it. We have a national, worldwide artist, you know what I'm saying, that we've produced for. So now we really have a little bit of leverage, so we thought, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, I mean, emotionally, it just makes you feel like your work, you know what I'm saying? Like, okay, finally I've arrived. I am worthy of this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's really do it.
Yeah. So you in like the ups, the downs, the ups again. You know what I'm saying? Now you up again. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now we riding on a high right now. We got the placement with Twista and everything's good. The group is good. We done relocated down to Atlanta, and we trying to get this thing really trying to get this machine really moving.
Uh-huh.
The freshmen come.
The freshmen we were always around.
Okay.
The freshmen actually started during the Project Fresh era.
Okay.
We decided that everybody that was a part of the crew that did not rap would be titled the freshman. So it was like management, engineers, producers, we would be titled the freshman.
Gotcha.
It just so happens that me and Mac were in the Project Fresh group.
Okay.
So, you know what I'm saying, we were also the freshmen as far as the producers go. So when Project Fresh wasn't active, we just kept the freshman moniker because we always said that we were going to bring Project Fresh thing back. Gotcha. So we just kept the freshman moniker when it came to producers.
Got you. Now, as the freshman, you got more placements.
Yeah, after that, I think we did, like, Raekwon record. We had Cassie. We had Jeremiah. We had Travis Porter. Yeah, we got like quite a few joints.
Yeah. The freshman placement was kind of, and I was seeing you know, social media was kind of new, Twitter was kind of new. It wasn't new. I guess it was fresh. Like people was just getting really grasps of it and starting to follow different people. And then you started to see that. You know, you started to see that. You know, the placement on Jeremiah, the placement on I think I saw the Cassie one, and I was like, man, these dudes really doing their thing. And you guys were traveling, going to different places and studios with different people. And because someone out of your group will always say, you know, will always tweet that, you know, in the studio with so-and-so, or we doing this with so-and-so. I don't know if it was you or some of the other guys, but I used to always see that. And I say, man, these dudes, my man Berg is really down there doing his thing, man. Proud of him.
We was moving around a lot. You know, at that time, we had management for the production team. The homie Dillaman, you know what I'm saying? Okay. He got the restaurant now over there, over by UIC. Shout out his restaurant. It's a pretty great spot. I went over there. But, yeah, he was managing us, so he was helping move us around with a lot of people. And then, too, we was doing a lot of leg work when we was in Atlanta. It was, like, really out and about networking. You know what I'm saying? Shaking hands and then just trying to get in where we can fit in, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Going to everything and anything. And that's how we started to build a network up.
Right. So what happened with that? And at what year? So you down there in like 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And the freshman is doing their thing, getting placements, you know, making moves. And at what point did the freshman end?
The initial break happened in 13. We just had like a whole bunch of, it was like differences within the crew. No animosity, just like differences as far as like what people wanted to do.
Yeah.
So we took I ain't even gonna say we disbanded at that time. We kind of took a break. Okay. I know myself, I just started to move around more with other people that I knew. So I would, you know, still go to studio, still work. I stayed in touch with the homies. We always talk, all of us did. So I want to say like 6-7 months after, maybe like 5 or 6 months after that, we actually had a meetup and we talked. And even at that time, like I think with management, it was kind of stagnant. So we all kind of like parted ways, management. We parted ways with management. We kind of parted ways with each other for a moment. Mm-hmm. And then like, I want to say like maybe like 6 months after that, we linked back up. We had new management at that point, and then we started to take another run at it.
Okay.
And this might have been like 2013, 2014-ish, like around that time. Dang, I can't even remember the exact years, but yeah, it was around that time, and we started to, you know, link up and do more stuff, and then we started to get more placements as a crew, thanks to our other management. We did, like, at that time, who did we do? We did Bodie Kane, Raheem Devon. We put out a few records. We were doing a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. I, I can't even remember everything. But yeah, that was that.
And then, when did the Mark Berg solo producer? Well, let's take it here. So you're down there. Then I know it's because I follow you, because I follow your story, and you're great with sharing yourself on Facebook and whatnot, man. So I kind of know some things that probably people don't know. You know, even though I haven't like personally talked to you, you know, you're great at sharing what you're going through at that time, at least some of it. You know, that whatever you're willing to share. So I remember the. And this was a few years back. Well, you told this story maybe last year, but I don't know exactly when it happened. When you came back to your daughter dance. Now.
Oh, yeah, that's a fast forward.
That's a fast forward. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So around 2014, 2015, we were still moving around as the freshmen, doing a lot. Around that time, we also had linked up with John Connor. And that's when we started to, you know what I'm saying, work with him a lot. We was working with a bunch of other people at that point, too. And then, so you got to think, because out of 6 month period that we had, I had started to build a network of folks. And I remember our management actually introduced us to Saha.
Okay.
And that's where we did the Saha project, the Black History 2.
That the freshman did the Saha, the first Saha project.
Yeah, Black History 2, yeah, that was okay. The freshman record.
Okay.
And we actually had a few records that we had did with him that was supposed to be on that project, but then he ended up holding those records for his album, and then he was working on his first album, and we would just, you know, I would make sure I was at the studio all the time, so the separation started to come because it was like, I feel like the difference in direction that we had the first time, I don't think any of us were really clear with each other as far as like what we wanted to do going forward. I think it was more so like, man, we brothers, like if we're not going to do this together, it don't make sense. So let's give it a crack.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So then I just feel like the direction went into a different space again.
Okay.
And at that point, that's when it just started to, you know what I'm saying, okay, I'ma just do my shit. You know what I'm saying? Everybody started to do their own thing. Everybody had their own thing at that moment.
Okay.
My man E was, he actually left Atlanta and went back to Chicago.
Okay.
So he was out of the loop. My man Mac was like, look, at this point, I want to produce this. I want to do this. I was like, all right, well, I'm over here, I'm going to do this. My man Jay was like, well, I'm engineering. And that became the thing. And it was just like, what the craziest part about it, when I say there's no bad blood, like, bro, we have a group chat where we talked almost every single day.
That's what's
all
up.
Of us.
That's what's up.
To this very day.
That's
like,
what's up.
Almost every day. Like, I'll go so far as to say just about every day we speak.
That's what's
so,
up.
So that's kind of where the separation came. And then I ended up being Saha's personal DJ. So then I would be around him so much. And that's when, like, we really started to work on his project. So I would sit with him all the time. So I would be in the studio every single day. And I remember he turned his project in, and this is when he was on Temp Jam, and they was like, nah, we're not doing it.
Wow.
And at that point, he was like, all right, give me my papers, bro, I'm out.
Wow.
And he went through a lot of legal stuff. And during that time, he went through legal stuff. You know what I'm saying? We stayed 10 toes down and we stayed in communication. So,
Hold on, Mark, let's back up one second. Let's back up. First of all, for the people who don't know, John Connor is an artist that was signed to Aftermath. So you guys were doing work with John Connor, with Dr. Dre's Aftermath production, label.
Uh-huh.
That was the freshman. Then you guys, as the freshman group, went to Saha the Prince, Atlanta, one of the dopest Atlanta MCs that ever came out of Atlanta that does not get his credit at all. Now, I got a mixtape from Saha the Prince from 2009, I think. Like my man Mark Webster from Deaf Sounds website was in contact with this cat in Atlanta, And he sent him this mixtape of Shy Hatta Prince, and he gave it to me, and I was like, this dude come out of Atlanta rapping like this? It was unheard of. But you said something that I know you spoke about. You said briefly that you became Shy Hatta Prince's DJ. Now, in our conversations, you was never a DJ. Like, we didn't even speak on that. Now, I know this story because I've seen your interviews and heard you tell it. But if you don't mind, you can tell the people that's listening to this exactly how did that happen. Because you was never a DJ.
Nah, man, I wasn't. It came from, all right, this is why I always used to stress to people, like, all of the emails and all of that is cool, but it's nothing like being in the room, just because you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
By being in the room. So when we were working on his first project at Def Jam, I only had, I want to say, one song on the project. Mm-hmm. But I just knew the importance of being in the studio every day. So even though I only had one song and my song was already done, I would be there every single day. Still. Because it's like, you just never know.
Right.
So it went from one song to like five songs.
Right, right.
And then it was just like, okay, so he needed a DJ for a show. I just happened to be at the studio. I was just there. Zaha's logic is, my other DJ was a producer. Bird is a producer.
Right.
I'm sure Bird can DJ. Hey, Bird, you want to DJ this show? What the hell? I don't know, bro. I don't want to tell you yeah, and then I get to the stage and fuck it up. Right. Let me go practice. So they give me the set on a program that I have never used before. I had the program, but I never used it.
Okay.
So I open the set up. I lock myself in a room for like 10 minutes. We're at the studio. I go lock myself in like a whole other little area.
Mm-hmm.
I go grab him and I'm like, yo, let's do a little quick practice run. I just want to make sure I'm doing this right. We do it. He like, oh yeah, that's money. That's all I need you to do. I'm like, all right, bet. So he's like, yo, go get such and such your information. And I was like, my info. So I go in and I give them my info, and it was like, all right, well, we're booking your ticket. I'm like, my ticket? Where the hell we going? I thought the show was going to be local.
Right.
It's like, nah, bro, we going to Utah. I'm like, wait a minute, when? It's like Tuesday, bro. My man is like, yeah, we going Thursday. I'm like, nigga. I got no practice. Like, bro, what are we doing?
Right.
So, and for me, just knowing, like, mixtapes and watching videos and just knowing how important, like, the DJ is. So, like, I went on stage and I would hype the crowd, and I made it my point to learn the songs that he was producing so I could chime in when I seen him losing breath and just certain things like that, because as a producer, this is what you do.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You make the overall production good. So at that point, like, he was just like, yo, that was crazy. Like, the chemistry was amazing. He was like, yo, I might need to keep you on the road with me all the time. And then we just kept jamming out. That's it.
Bro,
and that's how I became his DJ.
I saw the Utah show. I saw the North Carolina or South Carolina, one of them Carolina shows, and I said, "Oh man, Bert right there doing his thing. He like just Blaze back there on a Jay Z set. He getting the crowd hype and everything. I'm like, man, this is even though he never done it, you couldn't tell that he never done it before.
Yeah, it was fun, man. It was pretty fun."
That was dope. All right, we're going to take a little break, man. We're going to come right back. I got producer Mark, producer, songwriter, artist, DJ, Mark Bird. Listen to me podcast. We're going to take a small break. We'll be right back. Yo, we back, man. It's Listen to Me podcast with Ken Cook. I got my man Mark Bird. Super producer, Grammy-nominated songwriter. And what we left off at is Mark producing for... Well, he produced also, but also became Shy Hatta Prince road DJ, show DJ.
Yeah.
And like I said, like, you not being a DJ and how you was in the right place at the right time. But like you said, you got to be there. You know, sometimes right. You just got to be there in order for things to happen. And you was there and this happened. Now,
yeah.
You done did, you know, a few shows for Shy Hatta, and I guess now we, you know, you're the DJ, and that's kind of how you ended up getting the placement with Rapsody, right?
Yeah,
Are we at that point yet or no?
Nope.
Oh, let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
During the DJ period, that was like how I ended up working on The Life of Pablo.
Bam. There you go.
Because it was like I was DJing the show, and we had to go to LA. We had a show in LA. But prior to this, this is like right after I quit my job. This is when I was like, all right, I have to take this leap. I got to do this now. If I don't do this now, I don't know when it's going to happen. So I quit my job, and I was like super stressed. So I'm like, bro, I don't know how I'm paying for nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I don't know how I will provide, none of this. But, you know, when I quit the job, I was given confirmation. You know what I'm saying? I had a real conversation with the big homie upstairs. It was just like, look, man, prepare yourself for the hardest times of your life, because everything and anything will happen, but make sure you see it through, because it's going to be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So at that moment, that's when I quit the job. I just had the confirmation that it'll be okay. I'm going to go through it, but it's going to be okay.
Now, how long was you working the job? And you was doing the job and producing. Like, all these things was happening in the midst of you working.
Yeah, I had a job. Like, the time when I did the first DJ set, when we did Black History 2, I had a job during the Jeremiah Records, the Cassie Records. I had a job the whole entire time.
Wow, okay.
So, I quit the job, and like I say, everything happened, man. Like, got my car repoed, almost evicted pretty much. It was just like the worst. Everything was just crashing down. And then we had, like, I was making money doing a DJ set, and, you know, that's how I would pay my bills. And then we had this one show in LA, and I just remember telling myself, I was like, all right, either Kanye is gonna come to the show, or we're gonna end up in the studio with him. So I'm going to be prepared for it. And that's what I kept telling myself. So I was like, I'm not coming outside unless I have like 50 records I'm confident in playing. So I just stayed in the house for like a whole month just making music. I would come out and go run every now and again. It was just like nonstop making music until like the L.A. show. And we do the L.A. show, and man, that day was just so all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line is I ended up in the room. We ended up co-writing a record. He sent it. Well, he took it to the other room where Ye and them was. They heard the record and was just like, yo, whatever energy is in that room, would you keep it? And he came back and was like, yo, what you doing for the rest of the week? And I'm like, I can stay for a few days. He's like, that. Stay for a few days. Like, a couple days after that day, we send another record over. Like, yo, keep them here again. So they extended my stay again. And that, now we're at the part about the daddy daughter dance. So I come back.
Let's stay in LA for a second. So you're in the studio, and you said he took the record. Who was taking the record? Sahai was taking the records in there to let Kanye hear him after y'all, like, kind of pinned them and recorded them?
Yeah, we were just a long way from each other. Like, the whole entire music industry was at these studio sessions, bro. I was like, everybody was there when I was there. Like, everybody from Teddy Riley to Kirk Franklin. I was in the room one day with Mike Dean. Mike Dean was showing me some stuff about synthesizers. Rick Rubin walked in the room.
Wow.
Tyler the Creator, Knots, Pharrell, Andre 3000, Lil Uzi, Don Cannon.
Everyone is in these studios working on Life of Pablo? Or just trying to catch a vibe?
No. Yeah, everybody was there. Kelly Price was there. Whole Choir was there. Tiana Taylor, Kalani. It was nuts, bro. It was crazy. Like, Tiger, you just saw the Kardashians. You saw the entire music industry, like, Glorify. Everybody was there. Puff was there. Malik Yusuf, shout out to the Crib. He was there.
Yeah. Was anybody else from Chicago there? Because I know, like, King Louie had wrote some. I don't know if it was Life of Pablo or the other.
Don C was there.
Don C, okay.
I didn't see Louie, but they might have wrote something and sent it in, because you can also work remotely when you're working with them. You know, Boogs was there. I
Yeah, Bugs. Yeah. Another dope producer from the crib that don't get enough credit. That's crazy. So how did you know that the joints that you penned or some of the input that you had on some of the joints was going to get picked?
Nobody knew. Like, I didn't know until the album came out.
Wow.
So that's like going to the daddy daughter dance. It was like once I left LA, I came back to Atlanta, and my daughter had this dance, and I promised her I was going to go. So I had to pawn all of my stuff so I can get the money to go to the dance. And I do the dance. My mom's birthday was that Sunday. It was All-Star Weekend. My mom's birthday was Valentine's Day. So my homeboy, JL, from the freshman, that's how you know. Like, we still cool because he was driving to Chicago and I rode with him.
Right.
I was like, bet, I'm going to just ride with you. He was like, all right, bet, cool. So we have our weekend in Chicago. We get ready to come back. I'm sitting in the car with him. I got like $25. I got to give him $20 for the gas.
Wow.
Like, all right, I'm going to use this bottle. I'm going to go ahead and hit this White Castle and give me something to eat. My last little White Castle hurrah, because we ain't got those here.
Dang.
And I'm sitting in the car and I'm just like, man, I'm trying to remember the energy and the vibe from a week or so ago, being in LA working on that album from a week ago. So I'm trying to recapture that energy there so I'm not in bad spirit.
Yeah.
That's when one of the homies texted me and sent me a screenshot of the credits with my name in it.
Oh, that's when you was on your way to Chicago then when you got there?
I was on my way back.
On your way back.
After the daddy-daughter dance.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like the daddy-daughter dance was Friday. Saturday, the album dropped at midnight.
Okay.
Sunday was my mom's birthday, and Sunday is when I found out. Like, when the album dropped, I didn't think to even look at the credits. I was basking in the moment of listening to this album from one of the biggest artists in the world, and I was there. Like, I have real live stories. I was really there for the project.
Right.
So I was living in that moment.
Right.
Somebody else sent me the credits, and my name was in it. I was like, oh. Mm. Okay, cool.
Right.
All right, Jesus, I see what you did. I see why you told me to quit.
Right.
I want you to be home.
They got to be amazing because at a point, you had to sell upon all your stuff in order to fulfill your promise to your daughter, and that had to be a very low point in your career, in your life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, very.
And then to get that news that you made the album. Now, what songs? It's two songs, right?
Yeah, Feedback and FML.
FML, okay. And to see that on your way back and still not knowing, I'm sure, like, in your mind, before you got that text or that screenshot with those credits, you had to be thinking about what was going to be your next move when you got back to ATL.
Yeah, I was still thinking about that. After I seen the screenshot, I didn't care no more. I was like, everything will work out.
Absolutely. So from that point, man, now that's a high. You know, like, man, you coming back to the crib now, you coming back to ATL, you got these credits on like you said, the biggest artist in the world. You got two songwriting credits. Now how does that work? So you didn't know that those songs was picking. At that point, everyone is in that room that contributed to this album. And just by knowing how Kanye worked, like, he give everybody the credit. Like, if you're in there, you know what I'm saying? Everyone that's in there that's helping him create, they getting credit for it.
Yeah.
Now.
Very fair.
Monetarily, like, I don't, you know, we don't have to dive into monetarily of this. Like, money-wise, of you getting the credit for songwriting. But I'm sure you get, if you got a credit, you got some portion of that, of those sales.
Oh, yeah, you get publishing.
You get publishing.
Yeah, you get publishing, you know what I'm saying? And really, that's where, like, a lot of the stuff comes from. It's like, publishing is forever money. You'll always get paid off publishing.
Right.
So, even after I think it's, once I'm dead and gone, and the publishing from that still carries over to whoever I leave it to.
That's dope.
So it's forever money, like, for real.
That's dope. Also, that has to open up doors for other things to happen.
Yeah, at that point, it's like, okay, that's when people just like, oh, you got a pen too?
Right.
Hey, man, write hooks for all of these beats. Okay, cool.
Right.
Now getting publishing money for writing and for production. Well, I'll take it.
Man.
Give me all that. Give me all that.
All that. Now, you back in ATL, you got the credits. Uh-huh. What's the next step? What's the next move? What's the next Mark Bird move?
Man, I want to say like a day or so after I got back, I get a text from Saha, and he's like, yo, come to the crib. I go over there, and he's like, yo, yeah, he just texted me, and he slid me the phone and showed me the text message. And it was basically like the green light to work on Saha's album.
Mm.
So, I was like, let me be transparent. I was like, look, I want to get to work, but we don't have to wait. And he was like, what's the deal? And I told him, you know, saying what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, nigga, you should have hit me before. Come on, let's go get this shit. So we went to the pawn shop and got all my stuff up.
That's what's up.
And then we started working on what was not titled at the moment, but what ended up being No Dope on Sunday.
Very underrated album, man. Like, I still listen to that to this day, too. And I had it since the day it dropped. No Dope on Sundays by Saha the Prince. And you got like 5 or 6 joints on that one.
Nah.
Nah?
Every song? Yeah. Credited on every record. Produced 11 out of the 15.
Really?
And co-produced and arranged and, you know, writing credits on the other four.
Really?
Co-executive producer. Yeah, me and EA. Executive producer.
You got co-executive producing credits on that too? How did I miss all that?
It was never listed. Yep. If you look at the credits, man, every song, you'll see my name on every single song.
Now that's a huge, huge accomplishment too. Yeah. Now that's major, bro. That's major.
Yeah, that was dope.
Now he still at this time, was he going through the issues with Good Music or trying to get off or
he never had issues with Good Music.
Who was the issues with? Def Jam?
Def Jam, yeah.
Okay. Cause they didn't want to release it. Cause I know I seen some rumblings with him, like saying, you know, they don't want to put my album out. I didn't know if it was Good Music or Def Jam or whatever.
It was Def Jam at that point, and that was what was crazy is the album that ended up being No Dope on Sundays was a completely different album from the first album that we did, with the exception of one song. I think made it. One song from the previous album stayed.
And everything else is brand new.
Yeah.
And you touch every single song on the album.
Mm-hmm.
That's dope, bro.
It had something to do with every song, yeah.
Congrats, man. My hat's off to you on that one because that's a dope-ass album.
Man, thank you, really.
Dope. Now, so the album dropped. Are you still doing shows with them as a DJ or?
Yeah, we were still, what was crazy? Oh, man, it's... Okay, so I'm going to try to sum it all up real, real quick. Okay. I have to leave breadcrumbs and then I come back. So,
okay.
Once we get the green light to do No Dope on Sundays, boom, we do that shit. We start to work on it. I had to go back to L.A. In L.A. is... I hit John Connor. I pull up to a John Connor session. Me and him started to work on his project with his crew. In those sessions is where I met Dr. Dre the first time.
Okay.
It was just like a quick conversation, nothing too much. So then after going back and forth to L.A., working with John, still working with Saha, me and Saha ended up being back in L.A. working on another Ye project that never came out called TurboGrafx-16. We were out there starting on that one. Then we came back to Atlanta. Right after that, we get the phone call to go on the Pablo tour. So we ended up being on the Life of Pablo tour for like 2.5 months. lot of the songs started to happen on the Pablo tour.
Okay, so on the tour, you're recording the Sahad joint.
Yeah, we're working actively on Sahad's record while on the Pablo tour. So we was like going hotels, setting up shop, a couple times on the record with Travis Scott got cut on Mike Dean's bus.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we came back to Atlanta after the Pablo tour. Dang, what happened after that? We were still working on an album. Then we ended up, like, going to the question of DJing. After Ye's tour, we ended up going on a tour with Wayne, okay. Like, early the next year. So early in 2017, we ended up going on tour with Wayne. And the tour with Wayne is really where, like, in between that time from leaving tour with Ye, the couple months that we had on the ground, and then going on tour with Wayne is when El Dope on Sundays really came to be. So once we got off tour with Wayne, we pretty much had almost all of the album done. We took the extra few months to really shape the album, get the marketing and all of that in order. You know what I'm saying? I was really hands-on with a lot of stuff, talking to the label like every single day almost, mm-hmm. really making sure that this project came out. And then No Dope on Sundays dropped in November of 2017.
Okay. Right, and you end up being from producer, songwriter to almost a label head on trying to on making sure that album came about.
Yeah, yeah. It got to the point to where like I was the liaison between Sony because he signed to Sony, so yeah. I was the liaison between Sony and him. They got to the point to where they would not even call him; they would call me, and I would call him. He would like if he had an issue or he needed something, mm-hmm. he would call me, then I would call the label. So, yeah, I was an actual executive. I was a real executive producer for this album.
Dope. So now the album dropped. Do y'all do a listening session?
We did a couple of listening different places. The main one was in LA. He did a Q&A, and you know we were just hanging out. It wasn't like nothing like too crazy. Most of the listeners that we had was for, like, you know, label heads and, you know, people that really had anything to do with the album. Okay. Like, I remember having to go crazy. I remember going to play, we went to go play it for Ye, and, had to get his opinion. Like, okay, what does he say? Okay, cool, he signed off on it. But then we had to go play it for Sony. Then we, you know, it was that.
And what was the overall consensus of the album when you played it for Ye?
He pretty much loved everything, like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. He, like I said, he contributed to the record. Right. Did a verse on that side, that was crazy, fresh. I mean, to even just do a verse, come through like that. But yeah, everybody was cool with it. He was just like, man, he was confident in it.
Good.
But yeah, we didn't really have no pushback.
Cool. So now that's done. The album's out. You said you did a tour with Wayne. And where we at now?
So after the album is out, it's just consistent, like working as a producer and building up. Then in January of the next year, No Dope came out November 17th. So October, November, December. So December was kind of like, you know, you basically contacting who you need to contact. You know, typical producer stuff, reaching out to people.
Yeah.
You're trying to keep the momentum of having that album. So it's like interviews, beat breakdowns, whatever you got to do to keep the momentum going until something else happens. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing at that point. In January is the NAMM Music Conference.
Okay.
And I go to NAMM, this is January 2018, I go to NAMM, and I'm just hanging out, you know what I'm saying, it's like a reunion of sorts for producers. Everybody goes, sees all the new equipment, you hang out with your homies, you talk. So I'm talking to the homies, talking to my big bro focused. And I touched, because I was supposed to link with him at NAMM. When I got there, he was gone. He was like, I had to do stuff, call me when you leave. So NAMM is in Anaheim, but me being me, I was like, all right, Anaheim is like 45 minutes, an hour from L.A. I'm going to still stay in L.A. because I know once the conference is over at 4 or 5 p.m., all night long, niggas is going to be in L.A. working. So I'm staying in L.A. I'm not staying in Anaheim. That was crazy. I'm going to stay where the action is. So my first night, I'm like super tired because I hadn't been asleep. I get off the plane. I get my rental. I go straight to NAMM, hang out, call my man Focus. When I get back, he was like, yo, hit me when you get to your hotel. But mind you, I'm, like I say, I'm off no sleep. I'm on East Coast time. So I get to my hotel. It's like, finally, by the time I finally check in, it's like 8:30 p.m. So it's 11:30 p.m. my time. Right. I'm off zero sleep. I'm exhausted.
Right.
So I hit my man Folk, and I'm like, yo. He was like, yo, I'm at such and such. So I'm like, okay. Is that the invite?
Right.
So I just hit him back and I'm like, well, look, I can be there in X amount of time if you want me to pull up. So he's like, yeah, pull up. Get dressed, I go, because I'm just like, again, the importance of being there, just got to be around. Yeah. I'm dead tired, but I'm like, I'm going to go. So I go and I go into the studio. I had been there before with John. I had been there with Anderson Paak's management team wanted to manage me at one point, so I had been there with them.
Okay.
So I wasn't, like, I was familiar with the staff. I was familiar, so I go in.
What studio? What studio is this?
This is Great Studio.
Oh, this Aftermath Studio.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I go in, I sign my paperwork, and I go into the back room, and I walk into the room, and I open the door, I see everybody I know, I'm speaking, I'm like, what up? And then, like, I turn around, and he was, like, the last person I seen because he was, the way that the door swung open, he was sitting kind of, like, behind the door, so I couldn't see him.
Okay.
I turn around, and Dre was right there, and I was like, oh, shit.
Right.
It was like, you know, I met him before, but, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But, you know, meeting him this time, I don't know, something just felt different. So then we having a conversation. It was a bunch of, like, it was like, the vibes was crazy. Music was dope. And then my homie Todd put me on the spot and was like, yo, you brought the backpack with you. And Dre looked at me and was like, yo, you just came to chill or you going to play some shit?
Damn. On the spot.
Woo! Now I'm sweating. Yo, I'm like nervous as hell. Like, I'm sweating. Like, right. Oh my God, dog, I got to play right now. Stop.
Right.
So.
Let me ask you, Mark, do you normally keep shit with you? Do you normally got your boot bag with you at all times with music?
Man, I don't move around without it because you never know.
You never know, yeah.
Be prepared, man. You never know where it's going to go. Like,
y'all hear that? Young producers, do you hear that? Keep your shit with you.
Man, you might be out and about, especially at networking events. But if you out and about and you see somebody and they be like, yo, what you doing after this? Pull up. Shit, you gotta go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you ain't got time to be like, yo, let me go home and grab nine and go. You need to be prepared. So, I was just prepared. So, I started putting a playlist together. And in my head, it was like 8-9 of us in the room. In my mind, I'm like, yeah, as long as I can win half the room over, I'm doing okay.
Right.
I mean, you never prepared enough to play records for, you know, somebody who's the pinnacle of music production to you. You know what I'm saying? He's on my Mount Rushmore.
No shit.
So you're never prepared to play stuff for that type of icon. So I'm like, okay, if I can get half the room, I'm cool. And that was the whole thought process. Let me just play some shit that's gonna bang and win half the room over. And
but he had to know already that you was a producer, right? He did know.
Yeah, he knew.
Yeah, because that's the reason why he told you to play some shit.
Yeah. It's still like, you know, what really can you do?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, man, I don't know what happened, but everybody in the room left.
No shit.
And it just ended up being me, him, and the engineer. So, now my plan to win over half the room is fucked up.
Right.
It's just me and him, and he's like sitting across from me, looking me directly in my face. So, I'm like, if I fucked up, I'm going to see it on his face.
Right.
Oh, man, I was so nervous. And, you know, I pressed play and, you know.
Do you know what you played for him? The first beat that you played?
Yeah, I'll never forget that shit. Ever. Yeah. Yeah, I know the first beat, I know the second beat, I know the third beat, and the fourth beat. We only got the number four.
Okay.
We got the number four. And by the time we reached number four, shit went so crazy, we went back and we just started working on the first two. And then I worked with them for a few days, like, I want to say 3 days, maybe, yeah. And then I left, and then I went back. Before we went on tour, I went back again, and that was the time I think I was in with, I was in with Saha and Travis Scott for Travis Scott's album. And then it was like double duty. I would be like at Dre's studio, and I would leave and go over with Saha and Travis Scott, or it would be like I'd be with Saha and Travis Scott, and I'd leave and go to Dre's spot. And then we went on tour with Crit right after that.
Now, you working at Dre's spot, you was working still with John Connor, still working on some for him?
Nah. Don't tell me
you're working on Detox.
I'm not at liberty to say.
Come on. I'm trying to get the exclusive, my dude.
Hey, man, paperwork involved. I cannot play.
So it's safe to say that we should hear a Mark Bird beat on something coming out of Aftermath sometime, whenever.
It's very, 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 very possible.
Okay. All right. Cool. Y'all hear that? You heard it here first on Listen To Podcast. Mark Bird is saying he have some type of production, something happening coming out of Aftermath sometime.
A lot of stuff over there.
He got a lot of shit over there for them to choose from. All right. That's dope, bro. That's dope, man. So, and this has been years in the making too, man. This ain't no overnight. People say overnight, overnight success. Like if as a producer and you get to the level of a, where your name is ringing, like everyone know producer Mark Bird. You know what I'm saying? Some people might think, oh man, this dude just came out of nowhere and all of a sudden, bam, he did it. But they don't know the history of this started in 2000 or 99. You know what I'm saying? Whatever. You know what I mean? That you built up to this point, you know? And I think that's a testament of never giving up and always moving forward, man. You know what I'm saying? Always moving forward. Right.
Pushing.
And being at the right place at the right time don't hurt either.
Hell no, that's super important. People don't know that part. Just be there.
Okay, now, where we at? Where we at now?
Okay. So, after all of that, that's when me and Saha go on tour with Crit.
Okay.
Yeah, so we do that tour. And then, after that,
are you still the show DJ?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
So I'm like wearing every hat in the world at this point.
Every hat.
So after the tour, that's when things started to get crazy again. My best friend's mom passed, and then the day after that, my pop passed.
Wow.
Okay. And this is like maybe like a month after the tour, a month or so after the tour ended.
Okay.
So, man, it was emotional, super emotional time. So after that, I had to do both funerals.
Mm-hmm. Both was in Chicago? You had to come out of Chicago?
Nah. One was in Augusta, one was in Chicago. So, it was like when my best friend's mom passed, I was in the hospital with her and him and the family. So when she passed, I was there. I legit jumped in a car and drove right to Chicago the next day, and I was there when my pop passed too. So then I ended up having to go back to Augusta, do the funeral, then jet back to Chicago and do the funeral. And then after that, I flew right to L.A. It was the day after that I flew to L.A. again to, be active with Teyana Taylor's album.
Okay. So, now, which album is this with Teyana Taylor?
It's the joint that they released when Ye was doing all of the albums.
Oh, the seven single joints?
Yeah. Okay. So I was out there with Zaha working on Teyana's joint. They had everybody on deck writing and doing what be done to make it a great project or whatever.
Okay. And did you get any placements on that one?
No. All the stuff that we did, they were supposed to make some changes to the project, but they never did. So the stuff that we did, you know, got left on the cutting room floor.
Okay.
I mean, it happened. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But I mean, the experience, you take those experiences and you use them.
Right, no doubt.
So, after that, I came back to Atlanta, and that's when I was just like, I had to put a lot of stuff into perspective.
Yeah.
I had to put a lot into perspective.
Life was moving fast. A lot of things was happening, and you...
The yeah, loss of
your pops,
very
loss of your best friend, mom, and yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was moving like super fast. So yeah, like after that point, it was just like now it's like regrouping and reevaluation. Like, what the hell are we gonna do now? What's gonna happen now?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the space that I was in pretty much most of 2018, most of 2019 too was kind of, you know, just in a weird headspace, just dealing with all of that. But in 2018, there was these producers that I ran into at a beat battle, and they were amazing. And we ended up working a lot together. Okay. This is in hindsight, but it's, you know, it's coming up to, I'm building up to why. One of the producers, her name is Charity Work. Man, phenomenal. Like, super, super phenomenal. Me and her decided to create our own thing.
Okay.
And it was just like, at that point, it was just like, man, you know what? We've been putting in so many hours building up so much other stuff. At what point is it going to be something bigger?
Mm-hmm.
And at what point is it going to be, you know what I'm saying, ownership?
Right.
What point are we going to build our own stuff?
Right.
So that's when God level happened.
Okay. Okay.
And that is where everything rests now. She had an artist that she had been working with named Dante Higgins.
Okay.
And she was like, yo, we should make him the first artist. And I'm like, alright, if he's serious, let's do it. And man, all I can say is, this is when you're gonna get to see what it's really about. But it's a process, like building your own thing,
mm-hmm.
and having your own artist and breaking it through the layers of everything else, that's the process.
Yeah.
And it is a very long process, especially when you don't have the type of sound or artist that's like a quick, like, okay, we can just throw this on anything and it's just going to work just because it's trendy and it's now. Nah, this is a sound that's something else. So, that's where we at now.
So you have a what would this be? Would this be a label or a production company?
Production company, but man, honestly, we act as a label. Just okay. The way we do everything. So we, you know, we're still building.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We also have other parts of the company. You know what I'm saying? Shout out my man Black Bell, my man Lawless, my man Fuego. They are all overseas, but they are part of the team as well. We've been working with Dante Super Heavy, and we work with another Chicagoan R&B kid named Matt B, and we did a project with Matt over the summer, an EP with him, and that's pretty crazy. We did the whole EP, just okay. The crew.
Are these R&B artists, or are they just hip-hop, or what?
Matt B is R&B.
Okay.
Dante is hip-hop.
Okay. And is Dante from Chicago?
Nah, Dante is from Houston.
From Houston. Houston. Okay. Man, I'm looking forward to hearing that. Now, that's dope, bro. That's congratulations to you. And what's her name, Charity?
Yeah,
congratulations, man, on that move. I know it's going to be a grind, but just listening to and knowing everything that you've done thus far, you know, you're building your way up, and I'm sure it's going to be successful. It sounds like, you know, because you're relentless in your growth, bro. Like, you're relentless in succeeding. It's, you know what I'm saying? So I don't see anything stopping you. As long as, you know, you continue to jog your 5 miles a day, every day, drink a lot of water. So, man, so we went through a lot, bro. We talked about a lot, man. I'm very humbled and appreciative of your time that you've given me to record this, bro. And like I said, I've always been a fan of just you personally. It's not even about the music. Just I considered you always as a good guy. You know what I'm saying? That had a drive and a mission, and you haven't stopped. And just seeing your success over the years, bro, and knowing that, damn, man, I remember when this kid didn't have no production credits. Now look at him. You know what I'm saying? I remember this kid, you know. Man, it's I remember, you know, those years. And I think really we talked on the phone maybe twice, three times in 11 and 12 before your move to Atlanta. And talking about production and some of the local artists here that you was working with, and some of the local artists that I was dealing with, and was like, man, this dude makes some dope beats. Cause I hear your stuff. I heard your stuff on with the Project Fresh and with Penn, and like I said, with Burt Kennison, AKA Gutter, back in the day, you know. And man, always been a fan of yours, bro. And again, I'm humble and still don't understand that Chicago. I'm talking to Chicago. People, listen to me. All of you guys in Chicago, we got to hold down our own. And you interviewers and you bloggers and podcasters like myself, and I'm an amateur at this, you know, this is only like my 6-1, 7-1, and I am no pro at all. But I reached out to this man, and it was nothing for him to say I'll do it. And you, Chicago, man, y'all reach out to him, Mark Berg on Facebook. What's your Instagram is I am Mark Berg, or your Twitter is I am Mark Berg, right?
Yeah, everything is the same. I am Mark Berg. Yeah, everything. Easiest person in the world, fine.
Easiest person in the world, and very humble, man. And he didn't give me nothing about doing this at all. He was like, "Yeah, let's do it." So, man, this guy has an very interesting story. Now, I think we almost at the Nina joint where we actually started at this podcast, but I think we worked our way back up to it, or we're close to getting to you on the bus with Knife Wonder and whatnot, right?
Well, that was like when I went and met them was 2018 when I was on the tour with Crit, actually.
Oh, on tour with Crit, right.
Yeah, that's where that happened, but the record didn't. Well, 2018 when I was on tour with Crit, that's when I met them, and that's when we took the record. But it was just like a year-long process to the album coming out, and then we almost didn't get the record.
Really?
Because
why?
Because they wouldn't clear the sample.
I'm sure they had to be a hard one to clear, bro.
Yeah, it was like, I was just talking to Rhapsody like maybe a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago at her show, and she's my name, she even had Jay Song and trying to get that record cleared. It was just like, they just would not clear that record. And then, like, out of nowhere, I want to say it was a week. It was the day before they were supposed to turn the album in, Knife Wonder hit. And it was like, dude, they just called and granted us clearance. It was, like, legit the day before they had turned the album in.
That's God, bro.
Yeah. Really? That record was supposed to come out.
Yeah, no doubt. And, again, I'm telling all the people that's going to hear this, if you haven't heard Rhapsody, album, the first joint on that album is called Nina. The sample on that, the feeling that it puts you in, you know what I'm saying, is just crazy, you know. And man, Mark did his thing on that one, man. And I seen that you actually got to see her perform it live not too long ago for the first time, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. Yeah,
2 weeks ago. Now that had to be a dope experience right there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, man, going to, like, you know, watch the record be performed, and then, like, you know, to see the whole crowd singing along with the record is pretty, it's it's pretty crazy. Like, it's a real feeling, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, when she did the BT Awards, man, and came out to that joint, that was
That kind of weirded me out. I mean, you know, first time to hear your music played at an award show, that was pretty crazy.
Right, right. Well, man, look,
yeah.
Thank you. I thank you so much, man. Again, I am a fan of Mark Bird, the person, and Mark Bird, the producer, Mark Bird, the songwriter, all the time, bro.
My brother.
I'm going to continue to follow you, man, and keep up on what's going on. And, man, anything, it's a young producer that's listening to this right now, and I know a couple of them that's just getting into the game right now, a year in, a few months in, or whatever. What would you like to share with them, man, on just not so much the beat making or the producing, but the business side of it, and what should they take from this interview?
One, for sure, learn the business, you know what I'm saying? Know what you're supposed to get as a producer and understand your value when it comes to the overall creation and the process of things. Just to be totally honest, if all of us producers stop right now, nobody in the world is going to listen to acapellas. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. Another thing is just persistence, man. Like, it's going to get hard. You have to just keep pressing. You have to keep going. And the biggest thing is, like, man, just be likable. Because at the end of the day, man, people still got to like you.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You know, we've met people that were so talented, but be like the biggest jerks. And it's like, well, like, man, I know such and such is fire. And you're like, man, I don't even want to deal with that person's energy. And you can be take the greatest talent ever, but just lose it all off your personality.
Mm.
It's real. That is like a real thing. You know what I'm saying? That's super real.
That's a gem right there, man. People don't even think about that. You got to be likable. Nobody want to work with you, man, if they can't like you.
Yeah, and just, you know, be ready, man. Like, you know, don't give people, like, the reason I guess I've been able to move around is because I don't call for problems. Like, man, if somebody's like, yo, I need you such and such, cool, here you go. Right. Well, like, even with the Rhapsody situation, it's like, all right, they wouldn't clear the record, but we got this other version of it. I wasn't complaining, like, well, that's the one. All right, cool, man, I'll try the other version.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Easy to work with.
Man. That's what's up, man. Hey, Mark, I ain't gonna hold you up, man. No longer than need be, man. Again, I appreciate the time
you're
giving, bro. Man, and much success to you and your adventures, man, with your production company, with the artists that you're building. I'm sure it's gonna be great. Can't wait to see the first thing come out of that. What's the name of the production company?
God Level.
It gotta be dope. Ain't no not being dope with that.
No, that's just, we set a standard for ourselves.
There you go. Again, y'all can catch Mark Bird, MarkByrd, on Facebook. I am Mark Bird on Twitter, his Instagram. He did a live beat today that I was checking out, man, that he you know, just sitting in the crib and did his thing. So y'all check him out, man. I'm sure you know, you can see the workings of what this man does. One last question, Mark.
Yeah.
What's your biggest accomplishment to date?
Oh, man, that's like, I don't know. As weird as this may sound, man, it's just, Every day, bro. Just every day is my biggest accomplishment. The fact that I wake up and, you know, I've made the strides that I made. Like, not one of my accomplishments can top the other one because there was a sequence. Everything was supposed to happen. So the fact that I wake up and do whatever it is that I do today, everything that I did prior to that leads up to today, and everything prior to that made me the person that I am today, and every day I wake up, I aim to be better. So that's my biggest accomplishment.
Man, that's good. We gonna end it at that right there. Hey, Again, this is Mark Berg, man, Grammy-nominated songwriter, producer, show DJ, good guy, God-fearing dude, production company owner, God-level production company. My friend, I thank you.
My brother.
Man, much success.
Anytime,
bro. My man. I will talk to you later on, man. Thank you for tuning in to Listen to Me podcast with Ken Cook and my guest, Mark Berg. Conversations with Mark Berg dropping soon. Thank you, sir.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Yep.